There are two readings this evening. The first one is from Genesis chapter 50, verses 14 to 26, and that can be found on page 57. Genesis chapter 50, verses 14 to 26. After burying his father, Joseph returned to Egypt together with his brothers and all the others who had gone with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?" So they sent word to Joseph, saying, "Your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now, please, forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father." When their message came to him, Joseph wept. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. "We are your slaves," they said. But Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. Joseph stayed in Egypt along with his father's family. He lived 110 years and saw the third generation of Ephraim's children. Also the children of Machir, son of Manasseh, were placed at birth on Joseph's knees. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land he promised on oath to Abram, Isaac, and Jacob." And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear an oath and said, "God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up from this place." So Joseph died at the age of 110, and after they embalmed him, he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. And the second reading is from Exodus chapter 13, verse 14 to 22, and that can be found on page 71. Exodus chapter 13, verse 14. "In days to come, when your son asks you, 'What does this mean?' say to him, 'With a mighty hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery.' When Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed every firstborn in Egypt, both man and animal. This is why I sacrifice to the Lord the first male offspring of every womb and redeem each of my firstborn sons. And it will be like a sign on your hand and a symbol on your forehead that the Lord brought us out of Egypt with his mighty hand." When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on a road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road towards the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of Egypt, armed for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, because Joseph had made the sons of Israel swear an oath. He had said, "God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up with you from this place." After leaving Succoth, they camped at Etham on the edge of the desert. By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so that they could travel by day or night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people.
Well, good evening. Tonight we are going to continue our Hebrews 11 series by looking at Joseph, much as our readings would have suggested. And of course this evening, the Hebrews text is found in verse 22 of Hebrews 11, just this one verse, and it reads like this. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. Now, before I get to the purpose of that Hebrews text, let me note a few things about the life of Joseph. Many of us will be aware of the story, but oddly enough, it's not about brightly colored jackets or bad parenting skills. It's not about the breakdown in family relations. It's certainly not a book about how to work your way to the top. Like we have a successful man that gives us a model that if we were to follow it, we too could be successful. It's none of these things. And indeed, the Joseph narrative, the Joseph story, isn't even about Joseph. It's a narrative all about God, just like all the other ones to this point. As a piece within the Jacob narrative, the Joseph piece kind of lives within it, underlining a lot of the lessons that are to be learned through the life of his father. The main thrust of the Jacob narrative was all about how Yahweh was reliable. The very basis of any faith we have, the faithfulness of God. You see, he is faithful. He keeps his promises, even when the promises that he gives are completely outlandish and impossible. He keeps them. So God promised Jacob in Genesis 28, "And behold, Yahweh stood above it and said, I am Yahweh, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." So Joseph's father, Jacob, he receives these promises. He receives the promise of the land. He receives the promise of the line, the son of promise. And he's given hope. Because at this precise moment in time, he has nothing. He is lying there in the dust. He has absolutely nothing. He has lost all of his possessions. He has lost his home. He's about to go into a land where he is a foreigner. And so Jacob responds in Genesis 28, verses 20 to 21. He responds like this. Then Jacob makes a vow saying, "If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I will go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then Yahweh shall be my God." So he's saying, okay, Yahweh, you've made all these great big promises about things that are going to happen many, many, many years from now. And I'll believe you if you also deliver on the little promises that you've given to me. If you do what you say you're going to do. And of course, God does. We see this in the life of Jacob. We see this wonderful moment when Jacob returns to the land where God is seen to be faithful to him, just as he had been faithful to Isaac, and before that, Abraham. And so when he comes back, and he comes back with a family and flocks and possessions and riches, when he returns, he has a moment with God, and he erects an altar. And the altar he calls El Elohi Yisrael. Just wonderful. He says, and bear in mind, Israel being the other name for Jacob, it said that God, the God of gods, will be the God of Israel. He will be my God. You see, no longer will he refer to Yahweh as the God of Abraham or the God of Isaac. He will say, "This is my God," because he is faithful to his promises. He has done what he said he was going to do. It's the whole purpose of that narrative for us when we read it. And yet, when we get to the Joseph bit, when we get to the Joseph part of the narrative, you know, we've seen God being faithful to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. We get to the Joseph part of the Jacob narrative, and there's a great danger about to arrive. All the promises are suddenly under threat Because even before we as the reader are aware of any issues, God is being active. For there will be a famine, there will be a natural and terrible disaster that would have cost the lives of this family. And then all the promises of God for the whole world would have been in the dust. And so before we're even aware of it, God is working out his purposes. And I suppose the key lesson when we're reading the story of Joseph is about the sovereignty of God, about how he will not be thwarted in the promises that he gives, no matter what, no matter the decisions of men, no matter the natural disasters, God is sovereign. And it's very much the point of the Joseph story. A brother who is rejected, a brother who, having been sold as a slave, is considered as good as dead. God will work his purposes through him. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And so the story of Joseph, which really opens up in chapter 37 of Genesis, starts off with a problem. Jacob, of course, has been showing a significant degree of favoritism, but he always has. He's always loved one wife more than the other. In fact, he's loved one wife. He hasn't really loved the other. And it's not surprising that eventually, in his old age, he has children with his favorite wife, and they become his favorite children, the firstborn of which, of course, is Joseph. And so we start off the Joseph story with Jacob, appropriately. And Jacob is very much creating the circumstances that will lead to the family breakdown. You see, he's got a favorite. He's the one that creates the circumstances. He's the one that gives the robe to the son of his old age, the son of his favorite wife. He's the one that's insulting all the other sons. He's the one that's insulting their mothers. It's Jacob who creates this uppity adolescent and creates the situation from which the whole tale unfolds. And yet God is able to work with that. Just as a rather disappointing aside, and I think I should just put this in now, if we get a sense of disappointment now, then we can build up from there. Hopefully. How many of you have heard of Joseph's coat of many colours? Two people. Okay, yeah, okay. Several people and some people whose arms no longer work. Okay, moment for disappointment. There wasn't a coat of many colours. I always feel it. I feel like I've just kind of, you know, said that Christmas has been cancelled or something. But, you know, there wasn't a coat of many colours. Pasim is an outward garment that would have gone down to the wrists and to the ankles. It was an incredibly expensive outfit, and it would actually have been one that maybe a royalty in the area would have actually used. It's an incredibly expensive outfit. And it's quite telling that you give this robe of authority and royalty to this son when they're all fighting to be the son of promise. It's actually really telling. So it's not just he has a nice coat. There's a bigger threat to the brothers than that. And it's actually not just that he's the favorite. They know that already. It's the fact that their father is beginning to kind of almost see Joseph as a possible son of promise. More on that in a moment. If you wanted a multicolored coat, I pray you use the word rikma as opposed to pasim. We see that in Psalm 45. We do have a multicolored garment there for us to compare with. The point is, he has this expensive coat, this outer garment, that says an awful lot about the intention of their father. And it is a sign of favoritism, but it also incurs the anger, the hatred of his brothers, so they can no longer look him in the eye and say shalom. They can no longer say peace to their brother. This young man is given dreams and rather unwisely antagonizes his brothers with them. These dreams, which may have even implied that he was the son of promise, that they would all be bowing down to him. Maybe when they're thinking of it as a more metaphorically, that he might be the son of promise, as opposed to that they will literally be bowing down to him at a later point. And so they have a threat. They have a threat in their midst. And ultimately, they want to get rid of him. And these dreams are given mostly to participate these events, but also to give hope. So when Joseph is dragged away, that he would have hope, but also for Jacob, And the problem for Jacob is that he lets go of these dreams. He lets go of them. He doesn't see them as promises from God. And so when he is told that his son has died, he believes it. He believes that lie. And is in despair. And yet God had actually already given him hope, but it was never taken. And there are many, many times that God will actually provide all that we need in terms of hope, but we don't necessarily take it. It's an incredibly sad thing. We have a lie that lasts for 2 decades, unchallenged. Now, remember the purpose of the narrative. God is sovereign. God is in control because God is faithful. And what we have is we have this wonderful moment where the brothers are thinking, right, let's get rid of this threat, this interloper into this, the promises that have been given to this family. Let's kill him. And at the insistence of Judah, they're able to sell him to a group of Ishmaelites that just happen to be coming along that way at just the right time. These men just happen to take him to Egypt. They just happen to sell him to Potiphar, who works under Pharaoh. And he just happens to go on to be highly successful because Yahweh is with him. So in Genesis 39, verse 2, we see that Yahweh was with Joseph and he became a successful man in the house of his Egyptian master. Remember, it's not because of Joseph's abilities or work ethic. It's not that he pulls himself up by the bootstraps. The rise of Joseph is because of a sovereign God. And even when he falls due to the lies of Potiphar's wife, Joseph's life is inexplicably saved. Instead of being executed, which would have been the normal punishment, he ends up in the prison. And not just any prison, but the royal prison for royal prisoners. He just happens to end up there. He just happens to have cellmates that are just going to happen to be the means by which he will have access to Pharaoh himself and save countless lives. And so God continues to work through Joseph, gives him the interpretation to the dreams for his fellow inmates. And at the appointed time, he is remembered and he goes on to impress Pharaoh. Now, he's 30 years old by this point. And he has learned quite a lot in his journey. And so when Pharaoh is incredibly impressed with this young man, he says, no, no, no. It is God who gives interpretations, not I. We need to recognize this in our own stories. It's very easy to get sucked into how the world considers things. It's very easy to think that our lives are all about ourselves. I'll do it my way. We actually end up that, of course, God loves me. I'm actually remarkably special, you know. He's very lucky to have me. And we get it all back to front, all twisted up. And as odd as it may sound, my life is not about me. Much like Joseph's story is not about Joseph, it's about God. Every single breath that we have comes and therefore belongs to him. Now, when I was talking about Isaac, the patriarch, a few weeks ago, I mentioned the Shema. This is the cue for me to get quite excited. The Shema is the foundation for the whole of the Hebrew religion. If you remember, I was speaking about it because it was the words that were spoken to a newborn child, which obviously I had to mention because we were talking about Isaac, and I have a son called Isaac, and it fitted quite nicely. But it was a summation of the whole of the Old Testament life. It was a summation of the whole of the Old Testament. If you had to boil it all down to one thing, this is what it would be in Deuteronomy 6, verses 5 to 6. You see, the Hebrew people were supposed to orientate their entire life to God. Not a bit of their life, not most of their life. It wasn't like, well, here's my life for God, but this little bit over here is actually for me. They couldn't do that because of the Shema. And it says this. Shema Yisrael, Yahweh Elohinu Yahweh Echad, V'chavta et Yahweh Elohika Bika Levavka Uvkal Nafeshka Ukal Mudeka. Now, I say it like that on purpose. Not just an opportunity for me to read it out in Hebrew, which you got to admit, it sounds lovely. I say it like this on purpose because we think we know the Shema, so therefore we stop listening when someone reads it out. If I was to look at that very carefully, that Hebrew text, and I was to look at that very carefully, it should say something like this. Hear, O Israel. And into that, include ourselves. Hear, Gilcomston. Yahweh, your God of gods. Yahweh is one. Now love Yahweh, your God of gods, with everything that makes you human and with every living breath and to the very end of your strength and potential. There's no room for a bit of you that doesn't belong to God. Everything that makes you human, every living breath, all of your strength and potential, that is what you have to love him with. So everything you can say, everything that you can do, everything that you can think belongs to God in love. It's beautiful. And of course, the Hebrew people would say this first thing in the morning. When they woke up, that was the first thing they were supposed to do. They were supposed to recite it last thing at night. They were supposed to recite it before they went outside from their homes and upon their return. Now, this was not just some sort of bizarre ritual that they had to carry out. The Hebrew people recognized what it meant when you bookended something. So very famously, Psalm 139, verse 8 says, "If I ascend to heaven, you are there. And if I make my bed in Sheol, you are there also." It's not saying that God happens to be in just these two places. By talking about the heavens and the depths, it's trying to say that God is also everywhere in between. And so when you're supposed to recite the Shema first thing in the morning, and you're supposed to recite it last thing at night, it's supposed to say to you that every single waking moment that you have had should be governed by the love, the complete and total love for God that the Shema tells you about. When you leave your home, when you return, everything that you have done, everything that you have said, every person that you have met should be impressed upon by the Shema. Everything you can say, you can think, you can do should be governed and motivated and changed and shaped by loving the Lord your God with everything that makes you human, with every breath that you take, and with all of your strength and your potential. So they are supposed to be orientated entirely towards God. Every breath. I guess for me it's quite easy to be very conscious that every breath comes from God. It's no secret that I'm not always in the best of health. And in particular, it is my chest which tends to be most affected. In fact, only a few weeks ago, I had to require some significant medical intervention so that I would have any breath at all. So that I would keep breathing. It's funny when things like that happen to you because you become very conscious of every breath as you fight for every single one. You become very conscious of every breath and very grateful for every breath. And it changes, it helps, I think. It helps kind of mold me to help me recognize that every single breath that I have is his and not my own. It helps me to look back over the years that I've lived to see a story about God and not about me. Glad you're all awake now. I can look to the future. And I can see a story about God that is yet to happen, yet to be. I recognize a story right now in my present, with every breath that he has given me. It is about God. My future is about the promises of God. And I know that my future will one day be one where he arises from his throne and wipes away every tear. That changes how we live. Changes who we are, that orientation towards God. And when we look at Joseph, we see a story that is being written by the hand of a master craftsman. Joseph, who emerges from his trials as the right man, at the right time to save Egypt, and more importantly, with regard to his promises, to save his family from starvation. For in their hunger, they come to Egypt, where God has ensured that there will be food. Now, Egypt, where the family will settle, but not forever. Egypt, where they will be safe, but this is not the promised land. And I suppose this is why I must insist on Joseph's story not being about Joseph. It's not about his abilities or his determination. It's about God and what God was doing through him and in him as part of a wider tapestry that God was weaving. And so, because God is in control, God can use the evil that men intend, which is what Joseph says and was read to us in Genesis 50, verse 20. As for you, that's Joseph speaking to his brothers, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. Now, did Joseph have any idea the journey that he was going to go on when he had those dreams? Did Joseph intend to end up a slave? Did he think he would end up in prison? No. And yet the evil and the terrible events God used. God was not thwarted by any of it. God wasn't stopped in his tracks. Not one bit. So, all of that then takes us to this action of faith that we have at the end of his life. So when we turn to Genesis 50, we'll start in verse 24. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old. They embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. Now, most of the attention that we ever bring to the story of Joseph is very much about the bit that I've already done, the trials and all of the things that he went through and what God does with this man to save a family and save a nation. But the Hebrews text decided to say by faith Joseph at the end of his life, so thus pointing us back to Genesis 50. And what does he do at the end of his life? He made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. And out of his entire life, this is what the writer to the Hebrews decides is going to go down. Why? Well, you see, here we have a man who is utterly invested in the future, a man where death is no threat to the fulfillment of the promises that God has made. This is a man who, like all the other examples that we have seen so far, is so orientated towards God that the promises that God has made are as good as done, even though he will never see them. And so he says, he will undoubtedly and surely visit you. He will come. I know it. And when he does, here's what you do. The promises made to Abraham in Genesis 15, the promises to Jacob in Genesis 46, that explicitly say that Egypt is not their inheritance. That's not their land. That's not what is promised to them. And God will come and take them from there. Joseph believes it. Joseph believes it so much, he puts into effect his burial plans. And he does not invest himself in Egypt, where he is a very important man and could have a wonderful and glorious tomb. No, no. He instead invests in the future that God has promised. And of course, it is just, as he said in Exodus 13, verse 19, Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here. So when they leave the land, they take the bones. And there is this wonderful moment when all of the wanderings are finally finished and they arrive in the land that they were promised, or promised land, as we call it. And they arrive. And in the book of Joshua, chapter 24, verse 32, as for the bones of Joseph, which the people of Israel brought up from Egypt, they buried them at Shechem. It's done. And so, with regard to the story that we have of Joseph and this pilgrim life, this sojourning journey, which started because of a faithful action of Abram and Sarai, wanderings that take in Isaac with his faithful journey, determines the life of Jacob, here terminates with Joseph in an act of faith saying, when you leave. The book of Genesis finishes then looking forward to the promises of God. And this coffin that he leaves behind, this coffin that Joseph is in, acts as a testament to all the later generations saying, do not expect to stay in Egypt. Do not look to Egypt for your inheritance, because God has got something else for you. And so through the internment of the people in Egypt until the appointed time, we see the promises being believed in. We see it through the wanderings of Moses, Aaron, Joshua. And even though most of those people will die in the wilderness, they know that the promises of God are going to come true. They continue to carry the bones of Joseph until finally the promises of God are fulfilled and Joseph's bones are home. And the whole of the Old Testament will continue like that. So Genesis is straining forward for the promises of God, and so we get Exodus. And it strains forward, and it goes on and on and on, because even when they get the land, that's only half of the promise. The line of promise that comes through Judah, the line of promise that goes down through the kings, the line of promise that will terminate in Bethlehem of Judea. The whole of the Old Testament continually strains forward for God to deliver on his promises, knowing full well that he will, till we get to Matthew. And ultimately, throughout the whole journey, we see something which is underlined in the story of Joseph. God is in control. Just as we saw it in the story of Joseph, then we too can know this to be true. You see, Yahweh, who rescued Joseph, who becomes the great rescuer of his people, doesn't just give up on being the great rescuer. He doesn't stop being the rescuer. He doesn't stop hearing the cries of people and responding. And as with Joseph, the things that were intended for evil, God can use for good, can turn for good. All the failures of his people, the disastrous history of the people of God, is no match for his sovereignty. And whilst there are numerous times that the faithlessness of men have resulted in dire consequences for them, God's plans never stop. So, even though we do not know what our immediate future will look like, even though we do not know what costs we may have to pay, even when we're at breaking point, God, the faithful God, who has never broken a promise, who is sovereign, who has never abandoned those who earnestly seek him, never stopped his ears to their cries, he is still God. Joseph never planned to be a slave. He never intended to be imprisoned. And yet over time, God uses him in a manner greater than he could possibly have imagined or even hoped for. I mean, imagine, just for a moment, imagine how Joseph felt having been sold into slavery by his brothers. Imagine how he felt as they grew smaller and smaller and smaller until he was on his own. A slave, condemned, dragged to Egypt with no hope of ever returning home. Where then the promises of God? Where then all these dreams that he'd been given? And yet in slavery, God was with him and raised him up in Potiphar's house. Imagine for a minute then how he must have felt when he was thrown into prison to be condemned again, unjustly, unfairly thrown into the darkness. All too easy to relinquish the dreams, to dismiss the promises. While sitting in the darkness, it is very easy to forget what it is that we have been taught in the light. But God was there in the prison. God was there helping him interpret these dreams, giving the interpretations. Now, many of us may find ourselves in a place marked by confusion and grief and guilt and pain, and it is easy, so very easy, to forget in that darkness what we've been taught in the light, that God is sovereign, that God is no less God today than he was in the past. I'm not entirely sure what it is that's wrong with me, that God needs to repeat this lesson to me on a regular basis. There have been numerous times in my life that I've had to be reminded by God that he doesn't just simply cease being God because my own personal circumstances have fallen down around me. Many times, God has had to teach me the same lesson. When I've sat there angry with him, in a huff with God, saying, "That's it, I'm not praising you. I'm not doing it." And God has to remind me, and he says, "Am I any less God today than I was yesterday? Am I any less deserving praise today than I was yesterday?" Of course, the answer is no. And very often I have to recognize that the only thing that I have that can't be taken away from me, that can't let me down, that can't leave me bereft, is the rock, my Redeemer, who gives promises that cannot be broken, and who has promised that no matter what happens here, he will cry with me and he will wipe away my tears in the end. He is no less God. And because he is no less God, I have a final exhortation, I suppose, a conclusion, if you will, before I end. I talked about the Shema earlier on. A beautiful, beautiful thing. And that complete orientation towards God that it asks for. That it would be given to the children at the beginning of their life. That it would be the first text you were supposed to memorize. That it would be the text you would say every morning, every night. This complete orientation towards God. What does it say? It says that we are to love God. If we were to read more of Deuteronomy, we'd recognize we are to love God because he first loved us. When Jesus was asked about the greatest commandments, he says, "Right, Jesus, sum up the Old Testament for us. What's it all about?" It's what he said. He uses the Shema. He actually also adds a verse from Leviticus 19:18 about loving our neighbor as a secondary one. Love God, love each other. That's it. Love God, love each other. When I stand before him, which I will, he's not going to say, "Right, Dr. Hepburn, well, we've got the VIP room for you." He's not going to say, "So exactly what percentage did you get in your Hebrew exams?" He's not going to say, "How many sermons did you listen to?" He's not going to say, "How many prayer meetings did you attend?" He's going to look me in the eye and say, "Did you love me? Did you love my people?" What am I going to say? I'm going to say, "Well, God, I really was very busy. He gave me quite a lot to do, I'm afraid." Do you think that's going to wash? Do you think I can turn around and say, "Yeah, but did you see them? Did you see those people? I mean, come on." Do you think that's going to wash? No. Did you love me? Did you love my people? The whole of my life is going to boil down to that. The whole story of God that ends when I take my final breath will be summed up by the extent to which I can say yes and yes. Love God. Love each other. And this is real. I mean, the whole faith thing that we've been looking at in Hebrews, the whole people of faith, it's actually all about doing. It's all about action. It's all about things that we actually put into verbs. When I get there, I'm standing in front of them. It's not going to be, "How many times did I intend to love your people? How often did I go away and seriously consider loving?" He's going to ask, "How many times did you love?" Now, that's a doing thing. It's an action. It's not a theory. It's not a ritual. It's not an idea. It's something that has to be done. I mean, look at the people around you. When God says to love my people, he's not hamming it up. He's not exaggerating. I mean, look at these people around you. I mean, think about it. Think about, what could I do this week that would show love? What could I do this week? Who could I encourage? Who could I even just send a text to? That's a pretty low bar, come on. As I look around this room, maybe because of the position that I'm in, I'm aware of so much grief and heartbreak in this room. And we could make a difference to that by simply doing what God tells us to do. Love our people. If you don't know how to love them, maybe they're particularly difficult to love. I don't know. But if you don't know how to love them, go and ask. Ask them, how is it that I can obey God today, this week, and show you love? Faith is about doing. So what are we going to do? Think about it. What are you actually going to do this week? So you look God in the eye and say, yes, I loved your people. Love God. Love each other. It really is as simple as that. Let's pray. Gracious Heavenly Father, we do indeed thank you. We do indeed respond in awe that the sovereign God looks at us, is mindful of us, and saves us. We thank you, Lord, that we can indeed love you because you first loved us. We thank you that it is possible to love you. And we pray, O Lord, that we would indeed love you with everything within us, everything that makes us human. All of our love, all of our will, everything that makes us who we are. Pray we'd be conscious that every breath came from you, that every breath belongs to you, that our stories are stories about you and what you are doing. Help us, O Lord, to make them more about you. Help us, O Lord, to love your people in some sort of real and meaningful sense, so that we can look you face to face, knowing that we loved you and we loved your people. Lord, help us to make what we want to do a reality in this regard, I pray. In Jesus' wonderful name, amen.